I'm Graham Blackwell. My PhD is in artificial intelligence, computer-based artificial intelligence. I used to lecture and research at Plymouth University for quite a long time. And one of the things that I did there was to actually lead the university's team in a mobile telecommunications project, which is a big pan-European project involving various different mobile telecoms companies across Europe. And whilst doing all that, I learned a lot about the whole business of electromagnetic radiation, which is like microwaves, light, radio waves, the whole thing, because that's what they use, of course, for mobile phone communications. We were doing a project which became part of 3G, ultimately. But I was fascinated by that for various reasons, one of which was the fact that it became apparent there were lots of unanswered questions about what electromagnetic radiation is up to, what's going on between light and matter, what the interaction is, what these things are, in fact, how light travels through open space, through a hard vacuum and things like that. So many unanswered questions, and I thought, this is quite exciting, there's an open field here to explore. And I feel I have the advantage of not having a conventional physics background through university, and I did some physics at uni, certainly, and I've certainly got an A-level in physics, but I haven't had the conventional relativity, quantum theory stuff and so forth. So I started from the ground up, virtually, on that, working on it myself. Got loads of books. I mean, that's great actually working at university, actually, because you've got access to every book and paper that you want to put your hands on, which is fantastic. So I learned a great deal. I went right back to Einstein's original monographs, and I went back to original papers by Einstein, Podolsky and Rosen, other people like that, you know, and various other players, John Bell and others who put forward views. Obviously, David Bohm was quite a big player in the whole development of the whole field. So I learned a lot. And as I was learning, and as I was walking on Dartmoor, which helped as well, going and sitting beside rocks and rivers and trees and things, and just sitting there and thinking, a picture began to emerge of what actually is going on. And it's interesting, because if you go to the conventional science books, you get the superficial impression that they got it pretty well tied down. But when you look a bit deeper, what you discover is that, for me at least, whether this is true for other people or not, but for me at least, they generally tend to replace one question with about half a dozen others. Like, for instance, you say, how is the whole business of, a static electricity work? You know, a charged particle attracting another charged particle. And they tell you, oh, well, it's virtual particles in between them. Don't worry if you don't know those terms, it's okay. Well, the only thing that comes across to me is, okay, can you now explain virtual particles? Not only the new virtual particles that you've brought in, but how they get to do exactly what they're doing. And it's actually getting more complicated for me now than it was when I started. So, anyway, I sort of came at it from this sort of angle. And I found a very consistent, coherent picture coming together. And as I've developed stuff, and as I've looked at more research and more of what's going on, that picture holds up more and more strongly. And what I want to share with you this evening is one aspect of that picture, and how it really fits into what is actually a big, as I refer to it, a cosmic conundrum. It's a big puzzle. And I will show you that the universe is actually right-handed. I'm not the first person to suggest that, because there's a guy called John Wheeler, who was he's a physicist who's been around for a long time, and he used the phrase that the gods are weak left-hander, which tends to confirm, or at least tie in with what I'm saying here. I want to show you how that relates specifically in respect to specific yet scientific right-hand rule, which has been around longer than I have, by a guy called Fleming, which is learned by kids when they first come through some physics classes and so forth, how that fits in with what we've got here. Probably best now if I get behind there and start talking you through the slides and see where we're going. You've probably picked up the fact that what we're looking at this evening is about antimatter, and you'll be thinking, you know, why is my life going to be any different for knowing anything about antimatter? The point is, for me, antimatter here is just a vehicle, an illustration of a principle which I think affects us all in a very big way. Well, we'll see what goes on. And the tippers will affect us all in a big way shortly as well. Okay, so this is the subtitle, Why Antimatter Matters to You, A Cosmic Mystery Unlocked. Okay, so we're looking at antimatter, and it is actually, for me, it is a massive clue as to the way that the universe works, what's going on, how it's all put together. And because of that clue, we're able, if we choose, to move forward in science in a really big way, if we're not sort of blinkered by preconceptions and so forth, and we're able to start perhaps discovering all sorts of possibilities around us that we haven't seen even before. Okay, that's my general premise. The universe is full of clues about how things really are. Every leap forward in science has been made by spotting these clues and figuring out what they're telling us. And every great name in science has been responsible for searching out all these cosmic Easter eggs, like things hidden around the garden for kids to find. And that's a little bit how I see, you know, science. There's things hidden around the universe, and that if you just go looking for them, they scream at you because there's something about them that says there's something you need to know here. And we just have a look and see what it's got to offer. There's a few examples. For example, would anybody like to suggest who the guy is I'm looking at here?
You got Pluto again.
Copernicus.
Oh, right.
Spotted that the orbits of the planets made a heck of a lot more sense if they were around the Earth. The Sun, not the Earth. Okay, it took a while for him to persuade other people, but eventually it was persuaded, that they were persuaded that it was, in fact, the idea was propounded about 1800 years before that, but people like, what's his name, Pythagoras, that's his cotton socks, was anti that sort of idea and stamped it down. Anyway, that was one person who moved us a big step forward in our understanding of the universe by spotting an obvious connection. And of course, another guy who spotted an obvious connection, and he didn't dress in a suit like that most certainly, was Isaac Newton. He spotted there had to be some connection between things falling on his head or anywhere else. I think it's probably a bit of a myth, but never mind. And the fact that they fall down at all, there's a connection there. And he started working on that connection and told us quite a few. I mean, I think Newton did have quite a bad press, which is a shame because I think the guy was absolutely no question a genius. And he took us a long way forward, and what other people have done is not to in any sense disprove what he proved, but it all showed, but in fact just add to that and show that beyond certain limits, other rules have to come into play. And that's fair game, that's what's happening all the time in physics and science. Einstein, of course, spotted the laws of physics were contradictory unless there was something absolute about the speed of light. We're not going to go into that into too much detail, we can do that some other time maybe, but that was what he identified, that's where the theory of relativity came from, of course, and that's really turned the whole world, in some senses, upside down in the last 100 years compared to how it was looking before that. Likewise, Max Planck, he spotted that energy can't go off continuously, it goes off in little tiny bite-sized chunks called quanta. And there's a Count Louis de Broglie, a French guy, who wrote this amazing thesis. He was the first person to win a Nobel Prize on the basis of his doctoral thesis, which is quite an achievement, in fact, because you usually have to do quite a bit after you get your PhD before you get anywhere near a Nobel Prize. But he was the first person to do that, and that was because he identified this wave-like properties in particles, which was then gone on and developed by people like Schrödinger. And those two guys together basically gave us the beginnings of what we now call quantum mechanics, quantum electrodynamics, quantum thermodynamics, another name every week, really. Okay, let's move on. Paul Dirac. Now, Paul Dirac, he worked out, applying principles of relativity to certain characteristics of electrons, he figured out that relativity and quantum mechanics between them were telling us that there must be particles just like electrons, but with the opposite charge, a positive charge, where electrons have negative charges. And he hypothesised this matter, which was referred to, was given the name antimatter, particles with, or subatomic particles with opposite charges from the ones we're used to. And it was only a few years later that Carl Anderson actually identified these particles coming down in the cosmic radiation that's hitting the atmosphere. He identified particles which appeared to be in every respect like electrons, except they were actually moving the opposite direction in an electrical field, which meant they had the opposite electric charge, so they must have been what we now refer to as positrons, which are sort of antimatter electrons. And these two guys, between them, got things moving for a major astronomical puzzle, because of course, as soon as you get that, well, there are antimatter particles, well, why can't we see them? Why aren't they all around us? I won't jump the gun on that. Let's have a look and see what antimatter is leading us to. Firstly, it's drawing our attention very clearly to something about how material particles are put together. We'll approach that as we go through the talk. By looking at this carefully, we can learn about the universe and things that could prove tremendously valuable to us, not just about antimatter, but about the whole makeup of how things work in the universe. Obviously, you're all aware, living in, or being in transition town Totnes, you're aware we're running out of oil, unless you're going snorkeling in the Gulf of Mexico, of course. And we're facing all sorts of other challenges, and it does seem that technology isn't really up to it in terms of solving the problems we're finding. In fact, many would say it's technology that's given us those problems in the first place. So we need to really have a different way of looking at things, to see options that aren't even visible to us at the moment. Let's look firstly at a few things about antimatter. Firstly, it's very rare, very difficult to handle, and very expensive to manufacture. Antimatter is annihilated when it hits ordinary matter. The two just both turn into pure energy. Even on contact with air, it just ceases to exist and makes quite a large noise and a splash of energy at the same time. I mean, actually, if you get a lump of matter and antimatter together, they make, you know, the atom bomb look pretty paltry, in fact. In an atom bomb, a small fraction of the matter is converted to energy. When you get an antimatter-matter reaction, 100% of the matter is converted to energy. And that's a lot. Expensive. 1 gram of anti-electrons would cost about 25 billion to produce. A gram of anti-hydrogen atoms, this is, I think I asked at the last talk here, what's the most expensive type of matter in the world? Anti-hydrogen is the answer. It costs around $62.5 trillion a gram to produce. And it doesn't last very long because sooner or later it's going to bump against something and just cease to exist. So it's sort of it's very volatile and extremely expensive, and not the sort of thing you'd want to give somebody for a birthday present for both those reasons. Also, another thing about antimatter is if there were any amounts of it out there, you know, out in the galaxy, out in the cosmos, we'd spot it immediately. Because as soon as the matter and antimatter hit each other, they go into a mutual assured destruction, mad state. When they meet, and in going into that state, they actually send out frequencies of energy which are clearly identifiable. We know exactly what frequencies to look for to see if there's matter and antimatter bumping into each other. And there are clear signs of quite a massive antimatter pocket near the centre of the galaxy, probably something to do with the supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy. But in other places, there's almost none of it about. And the other thing, as I've just mentioned before, if it were controllable, antimatter would be a wonderful fuel. Apart from the fact it probably costs far more to produce in terms of energy than you get from it. So they convert 100% into energy. 10 kilograms of antimatter would produce enough energy to keep a car moving, going along for 1 million years without stopping. So that's quite an achievement. Some people would say it's less than 10 kilograms. In fact, it's about 2.5 kilograms of antimatter and the corresponding amount of matter. But the problem is that in that when they actually bump into each other, a lot of the energy disappears straight out as neutrinos, which we can't actually get hold of and use. So I think 10 kilograms is a very reasonable estimate. Okay, the other important thing which I want to focus on tonight is the fact that antimatter is telling us something really fundamental about how particles are formed, what sort of stuff the universe is made of. Okay, Dirac and his work, his equations and scientists since are saying that it's pretty clear that at the time of the Big Bang, there must have been about the same amount of matter and antimatter formed. So immediately the question arises, why is it so unequal now? Yeah? Where's it gone? What's happened to it? And that's actually a question that's been exercising scientists for quite a while now, and there have been a number of Nobel Prizes given to people who've got just fragmentary beginnings of spotting clues towards the answer. The popular view, and this is a fun one, is that only 1 in 1 billion or so bits of our stuff are produced other than the other stuff. So, you know, you've got 1 billion anti-electrons and 1 billion and 1 electrons. And 1 billion of each annihilate each other and left one of us. Sounds cool, doesn't it? Sounds alright, because, I mean, 1 billion against 1 billion and 1, that's nearly exactly equal. But, the thing about that, statistically, if that's happening just by chance, then equally by chance at other times, there'll be 1 billion and 1 antimatter particles and 1 billion matter particles. And you find that to end up how it is now, after they've wiped each other out as much as possible, then in order to have the matter that we've got, that same difference of balance would have had to tip the same way, well, that many times, quite a lot really. And that is just not within, and in fact, if you work it out statistically, which I have, the odds of that being possible is zero to, about 70 decimal places actually. There are quite simple statistical tests you can apply to show that it couldn't have happened by chance. And in fact, to be fair, I don't know whether that idea originally came out as like it could have happened by chance, but I think to be fair, it's true that we now have quite a lot of evidence that it wasn't by chance, because we do now have some information relating to differences between matter particles and antimatter particles. Let's just move on and see what goes on. So either there were a lot more of the one created at the beginning than the other, or for some reason one of them has lasted a heck of a lot longer than the other, for reasons which haven't yet been identified. Okay, so we're now going to start unwrapping this thing and see what's inside this incredible piece of information and what it can tell us. Okay, so let's go back to Brooke de Broglie, the Count, who did his PhD on his thesis. He showed us that subatomic particles have wave-like properties. We've known that, everybody knows that, you know, that particles have got wave-like properties. We see things like What the Bleep and stuff like that, films that tell us that, you know, there is a lot of overlap between particles and waves. And there's lots of experiments that have proved that as well. So it's not just folk myth, it's actual scientific fact. Schrödinger's wave equation, which is the basis of quantum mechanics, and that's his equation for matter, which is actually a wave equation. It defines material particles in the form of a wave equation. It's the most scientific, you know, most successful scientific theory we've ever had, quantum mechanics, and its developments into quantum electrodynamics, quantum chromodynamics, and then so on. Schrödinger also identified an interesting little thing, a sort of a jittery motion, Zitterbewegung, he called it, because he was German, in electrons, which suggested that there was something going around inside electrons at the speed of light. And interestingly, and very excitingly, for those of us that follow these things, there's a group of French researchers who've recently actually confirmed this by experiment. They have demonstrated by experiment that there is a regular cyclic motion within an electron, which is actually able to cause physical effects in the behaviour of an electron by passing it through crystals and stuff, which is very interesting. So we do have here something going on in a wave-like motion inside electrons. And there's other researchers who have actually shown that various properties of an electron, the quantum properties of an electron, things like charge and spin and those sort of things, can be explained by describing an electron as a sort of wave motion going round in tiny circles, very tiny circles, rather than in straight lines. So this is what we're looking at, the possibility of an electron actually being light or something like it, going round and round in tiny circles rather than just heading out across space in a straight line, which is what we used to like doing. And of course, for those of you who have seen it before, and those of you who haven't as well, the book Tapestry of Life, which I've written, describes how all the experimental findings of special relativity can be explained by particles of matter being made out of photons, which are in fact little packets of light, if you like. So there we have guys who've shown the connection of light going in a circle, fitting with quantum mechanics, and here we have light going around in a circle, fitting various results of Einstein's special relativity. And actually, you can follow the math through and see how those results are produced, whereas Einstein actually intuited quite a few of those, and they've been shown by experiment to be true, but there are not equations which show the connection between what a particle is and why it does what it does in that way. So now we need to know a bit about light, and this is where it gets a little bit techy, but just hang on to your hats. Firstly, light is a transverse electromagnetic wave effect. That's nothing to worry about. You're used to probably seeing light as a wave going up and down, up and down. In fact, light is effectively two waves together, one going up and down, and one going side to side, because it's electric and magnetic. It's an electromagnetic effect. And all you need to think of is basically, you know, like a roller coaster going up and down and a horizontal roller coaster going along beside it. And they just they push each other along effectively. Well, I'm sure physicists would hate to hear me say that, but that's in a sense what the equations are saying they do. And that's Maxwell's electromagnetic field equations. And if you just think of a blue yo-yo going up and down, a red yo-yo going left and right, both going back and forth or up and down, and each one pushing the other one along as it goes, so they go in the direction that the arrow points. That's what light is, and that's what radio waves are, that's what microwaves are, gamma rays, all those sort of things. Okay, so that's really what light is. And we need to notice here that actually it's always the same arrangement, always. If you look at the arrangement there, the magnetic field is always a quarter turn clockwise from the electric field. If you look in the direction of the arrow, if you look from the left hand end down the dotted line towards the arrow, and you see the electric field going up while the magnetic field is going off to the right. And then when the electric field goes down, the magnetic field goes off to the left. So it's always a quarter turn clockwise. That's the crucial thing. It's always clockwise. When the blue is up, the red is right. When the blue is down, the red is left, if you look in that direction. And there we have the right-hand rule. Fleming's right-hand rule, which tells us exactly what happens if you put electrical fields and magnetic fields together. If you take your right hand, literally just put your fingers out like that and your thumb like that, If you have the three hours, sort of like all at right angles to each other, if your finger points in the direction the electric field is going in, your index finger, if your second finger, your middle finger points in the direction the magnetic field is going, then your thumb is pointing in the direction that the light would be going. Okay? Now the interesting thing is, there is a Fleming's left hand rule, but it doesn't apply to the way the electromagnetic fields propagate or travel through space. It's the right hand rule that applies. This is why I say the universe is right handed. Basically, if we're thinking about energy travelling as light rays and radio waves and things like that, if we're thinking of matter being made up of light going around in a circle, all of it obeys that rule. Every bit of the universe obeys Fleming's right hand rule. There isn't a corresponding left hand rule which some of the matter obeys. There isn't. Because that's what Maxwell's electromagnetic wave equations tell us, and he figured all that out, and that was how they got to the idea that light was an electromagnetic wave phenomenon, because the equations tell us that's what it does. That's it, really. There you go. We could stop there, but perhaps you need a little bit more elaboration. Okay, there's no such thing as a true mirror image of any photon, because if you wanted a photon, you know, you've got a photon with the waves going up and down and left and right. When one bit's up, the one bit's to the left. When it's down, it's to the right. When it's up, it's to the right. When it's down, it's to the left. And you can't get it the other way around. There is no way you can get electrical and magnetic fields to do that the other way around. It just doesn't happen. Okay? So the mirror image photon for any photon of light does not exist. So where do we go from there? So if matter is made from photons, it's not possible to produce a perfect mirror image of any particle either. Because your particle will have the photons which are inherently a certain way around. The antiparticle will have photons which are the same way around as the original particle. You can't get them reflected. You can't get reflected photons inside an antiparticle. So we have an asymmetry. The cosmos, the universe is not symmetric. We can't create, let's say we had a particle which is made up of a certain type of photon. If we tried to create an antiparticle which is made of exactly the mirror image, we couldn't do it because you cannot get a mirror image of a certain type of photon. So if you're going to cobble together an antiparticle, it's got to be done with the same sort of ingredients as they use the particles. So where does that take us? Okay, let's consider the issue of the garden slippers. Here we go. Hang on to your hair, Robert. Okay, there's this garden equipment manufacturer who makes garden clippers. Of course, he starts by making right-handed garden clippers because that's where the majority of the market is. Then he gets working quite big and there's people coming in wanting left-handed clippers, so he makes left-handed clippers, but there's a little bit of a snag. And the snag is that actually he can only get hold of clockwise-threaded screws. And he screws up one type of clippers with his clockwise-threaded screws, and that's fine. Screws up the other type of clippers, and he keeps getting people coming back and saying, they keep coming loose. Because the thread's not working, because it's inherently undoing itself rather than doing itself up every time you squeeze it. Do you see the difference? Mm-hmm. So you basically, if you try and make the opposite type of thing with the same type of basic ingredient, you get one which will be less durable, less stable than the other. And that basically is my contention, that's what's going on with particles and antiparticles. Which is why, whether or not as many made themselves in the first place, or whether it's just they've sort of collapsed in the since then, that's why we don't have the same amount each. Because in fact, there is one way of putting a particle together which makes it strong and robust and it lasts forever, and presumably another way which makes it come undone eventually. Presumably, that's what the suggestion is. Let's have a look at a bit more detail on that. You've probably heard about polarized light. You've undoubtedly heard about polarized spectacles and sunglasses and things like that. That's because basically light can be vertically polarized, that's the wave going up and down, or horizontally polarized, that's left, right. And in this we'll talk about the electric field. The magnetic field is generally left out of the discussion, but the magnetic field is always at right angles to the electric field. So the waves can be running vertically, horizontally, or at an angle, they could be going across. And of course if you get scattered light, for instance, this is where your polarised sunglasses come in. If you get scattered light coming off like a water surface or something like that, or off the snow, it's coming at you at all different angles, and it creates a blurry effect. Whereas if you can polarise the light and only cut it out so that only certain directions of light come at you, that makes your view much clearer, much more lucid. So that's what polarisation is about, basically. It's light coming up, travelling at different angles in terms of the way the rays go. You can also have elliptically polarised light, where instead of just going up and down, the waves are actually going sort of spiralling around as they go along. And those spirals could be very squashed, or they could be out to a perfect circle virtually. And that's what's called elliptically polarised light. But the interesting thing is, every one of those numerous different polarisation states can be actually made up from a combination of just two modes of polarisation. And it seems to me that these can be viewed as the fundamental states of light. One is where it's sort of like corkscrewing through space in a clockwise direction. The other of which is corkscrewing through space in an anti-clockwise direction. So we have two different polarisations, which seems at first sight to suggest that something's not right about what I told you before. I told you you can't have symmetry. We have got symmetry there in the electrical fields. Okay, for the right-handed corkscrew, we've got a corresponding left-handed corkscrew. But watch carefully when we get a bit further on. And any particle, I mean, it follows, if every type of light can be made from those two types of polarised light, then it follows that any particle that's made of light must be made up of a combination of those two. It's got to be. That's all there is. So we're saying basically that any particle is made up with clockwise, anti-clockwise, or can be resolved into clockwise and anti-clockwise polarised light, going round and round in tiny, tiny circles. Now, let's have a look what goes on there. We've said a few minutes ago that the particle formed from one circuit polarised photon wrapped around the enclosure would have quantum properties just like an electron. I told you about these guys that found that in their research. And it follows to me, pretty logically, that that means that the electron, this is something they bring out as well, that the electrical field from the electromagnetic field effect that is a beam of light, the electric part of that is going outwards, giving the electron its negative charge, and it's also going inwards, undoubtedly, sort of holding the thing together. So the electric field is acting outwards and inwards, giving electric charge around the thing, the negative charge from an electron, and it's going inwards, so it's causing the electromagnetic effect to bend round itself and close into a loop rather than keep going straight on. That, to me, is exactly what's going on to cause a tiny closed loop. And, of course, that fits neatly because what you'll then have is if the magnetic fields are at right angles to that, then they will act, if you like a little row of bar magnets going around the outside. You can just visualise that. Electric fields going in and out, bar magnets, the magnetic fields going round the sides, effectively holding the thing together, binding the whole object together. You can see how that works and how it makes a nice structure. It seems almost certain, it has to be the case, that if that's what's going on, then a positron, the opposite of an electron, would be formed from the other sort of circuit polarised photon. Now we would have clockwise and anti-clockwise. So let's say that the electrons form from the clockwise one, the positron, being the opposite, has to be formed from the anti-clockwise. That's the way it's going to happen. And it would then give the opposite charge acting outwards, giving a positive charge. It would also have the same magnetic effect going around the opposite direction, but still going around the surface of the particle holding it together. So we see here a nice, neat little picture of how you get an electron and a positron. Do, by the way, ask if there's any questions or any puzzlements or anything. This is totally confusing. I don't know what this guy's on, but it's not making any sense to me. Please do so. But that's really where we're getting to so far. But please don't hesitate to stop me and buy one or stop me and ask one if you feel it's appropriate for you, if you'd like to. So basically what we have here is a picture of photons of light, one wrapping around one way, one wrapping around the other way to give an electron and a positron. And it has to be that one is effectively would be the circular polarisation in one direction. If that's the case, then the other direction of circular polarisation would give an opposite form of particle. Okay, now, we have also seen this, back to our right-hand rule. So where does that come into it? If we've seen a left-hand and a right-handed, we've also seen how this poor guy wasn't doing so well with his left-handed clippers as he was with his right-handed clippers. So what's that got to do with it all? So it makes sense that if you've got a positron made of one type of structure, let's say a left-handed structure, based on an intrinsically clockwise, okay, you've got this Fleming's right-hand rule, a photon is intrinsically a clockwise element, but it's had a left-handed spiral applied to it, and one's the same sort of photon, but going basically intrinsically clockwise, but applied a right-handed spiral. So you've got Let's have a look. Perhaps it'll make more sense if we have a look and see the pictures. So let's have a look at those two again. We decided, didn't we, that they pretty much look symmetrical. You can't see anything about those that's not symmetrical. One's a clear mirror image of the other. And that's just the electrical fields of each photon. That's a spiral, clockwise spiral being a clockwise polarised, circularly polarised photon, anti-clockwise spiral. And I'm suggesting, and it seems to make a lot of sense, that one of these would be used to form, if I were God, would be used to form an electron, and one of those would be used to form a positron, the opposite, because they would have opposite properties. But if we actually, it's difficult actually to superimpose on that the magnetic field with it, it just makes the whole thing look very confused and very jumbled. But if we just look at one fragmentary point, just have an instant, and look and see what's happening to the electric and the magnetic components just at one instant, you'll see at the top there, the electric component is the blue line, which on the right hand side is pointing rightwards, and on the left hand side is pointing leftwards, yeah? Okay? And the red line is the magnetic field. If you use your Fleming's right hand rule now, you just sort of do a strange thing, and you think about your thumb pointing upwards, your index finger pointing in the direction of the blue line, and then your middle finger is going to point in the direction of the red line. Can you see that? And that's going to be true whichever of those two diagrams you go for. Yeah? That works for both of those. But because it works for both of those, one thing that you cannot say now is that those two things are symmetric. One is not a mirror image of the other. And that's where we get to as soon as we start looking at how a photon of light is actually made up. And we start saying, okay, we'll use the clockwise version to make an electron, we'll use the anti-clockwise version to make a positron, the opposite one. We suddenly find that they both got that intrinsically right-handedness about them. So one of them will be effectively trying to go against the grain, and a bit like the clippers, rather than actually having that robustness and sturdiness, it's likely to have an intrinsic weakness because the layout of the electrical and magnetic fields is not corresponding in the two. All that I'm trying to bring to your attention to here is there is not a symmetry about those two. They are asymmetric. They are not corresponding mirror images of each other. So there's no way that you could make two different particles, one from one from the other, which actually turn out to be effectively exact mirror images of each other. And if they're not mirror images of each other, there is no reason why one should have exactly the properties of the other. And there is every reason why one of them could turn out to be weaker, less robust, less long-lived than the other. Okay, I think you can all see the point about the blue and the red lines and the lack of symmetry once we start looking at the composition of these things. Just like the two types of shear, these two types of photons both have a built-in, effectively, a right-hand thread element. They are both subject to the right-hand rule. So a left-handed particle, let's say the anti-clockwise one rather than the clockwise one, could turn out to be less stable. There's every reason to believe it might well do. And looking around us in the universe, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it is. Okay, let's have a look at what's been going on the Nobel Prize front. 1980, Cronin and Fitch actually proved what's called CP symmetry breaking. Basically, it means charge and parity. Effectively, CP symmetry would say if the charge is opposite and the parity is opposite, i.e. it's the mirror image, then they would both be effectively the same. So basically, charge and parity opposites would make the corresponding particles. But what Cronin and Fitch discovered is if you actually change the charge of a particle from a negative to a positive, let's say you have an antiparticle electron instead of an electron, and you change the parity, you look at it as a mirror image, it isn't symmetric. It doesn't behave in the same way. There are certain characteristics of the one that aren't characteristics of the other, which is you would expect them to be the same if there was symmetry. And that was a bit of a shock, actually, because there are certain elements of symmetry that have been regarded as being inviolate since the beginning of the universe, and to discover that CP symmetry, charge parity symmetry, does not hold, that there are particles that don't exhibit that symmetry, when you take the antiparticle and you look at it in a mirror image, it doesn't work. Which ties in exactly with what I was saying about these spirals and so forth. In other words, antiparticles are almost, but not quite, perfect symmetric opposites of conventional particles. That's exactly what we'd expect from this analysis if particles are actually made from photons of light. 2008, a couple of years ago, three Japanese researchers took the step a bit further. They shared the Nobel Physics Prize for identifying certain types of processes through which CP symmetry breaking occurs. They introduced, well, one of them introduced new types of particles into the equation, which actually explained to some degree what was going on, although it's fair to say that one of the three said at the end of his presentation, right at the end of it, you can see it on the, you know, the Nobel website, you can see his presentation, his slides and so forth, we still can't explain why it is that conventional matter dominates the universe and why it is that there's hardly any antimatter around. That's effectively what you're saying. So their discoveries, although it underlined the point that I've been trying to make, it didn't offer a complete description. They weren't, of course, coming from where I'm coming from. They weren't talking about particles being made of light or anything like that. They were simply saying, we have discovered there are other types of particles coming into the mix which actually tend to reinforce this view and show a little bit what's going on, but we still don't know why it happens. But, of course, if we can see that matter is shaped from stuff which is not symmetric, and what I'm proposing is shaped from light, and light is not symmetric, then we can see a reason why they wouldn't be the same in their behaviours. So what? Does that cost you an empty? What difference might that make to your life or mine? Well, firstly, so the closed loop photon description of matter links a known handedness in photons. We've seen that. That's been in the textbooks for, well, since I was a kid, certainly. Although people haven't really drawn attention to it because they haven't seen it important. Nobody's really noticed it or thought about it. Photons do have a particular right-handedness about them. And there's also a very apparent asymmetry in the universe. You look out there, you see lots of matter, virtually zilch in the way of antimatter. And you think, could there be a connection between these two? Seems pretty likely, because both of those are fundamental aspects of the universe. The stuff that's out there is the universe. The stuff that we call light is fundamental to the construction of the universe, particularly when you bear in mind Einstein's connection between E equals mc squared. Energy and matter are just variants of the same thing. So effectively, we have here a straight connection between the universe out there and what we see in it, what we experience in it, what we don't see in it, and the matter of the material, the raw material of the universe, which is energy. And if we take on board the idea that particles are made from light, then it all fits extremely easily. And that actually seriously strengthens the case of particles of matter being formed from photons. The idea that one well-known cosmic asymmetry is unrelated to the other one isn't really credible. You can't really say, well, there's this asymmetry and there's this asymmetry. They're both fundamental to the universe, but actually there's no connection between the two. Couldn't be. Especially when we look at the amount of evidence there is which links energy and matter together as two aspects of the same thing. If we start from the premise that matter is actually formed from closed-loop photons of energy, that opens up phenomenal new areas of scientific research possibilities. I said at the beginning that we've actually got a lot of problems facing us at the moment, like where we're going to get our energy from when the oil runs out, like how we're going to deal with various other issues. Not only that, we also need to have a rather higher level understanding of how material reality works, what it's about, what we're about. And this offers us the possibility of in some way getting to understand a bit of a higher level understanding of what the universe is doing, what it's about. And that is fundamental and essential at this point in time. Okay, we're hitting the buffers on all those things. Einstein said that no problem can be solved at the same level of understanding that first created that problem. That makes sense. You try and use the same technology to solve your problem as you did to create your problem, just like sawing bits off the chairlift, basically. And you're not going to solve it. So we need a higher level of understanding. We need to understand more clearly what the universe actually is, and hopefully to some extent, what it's about. Okay, I'm suggesting that this insight into the nature of physical reality, what I refer to as the gift inside the Easter egg of the antimatter conundrum, that gives us tremendous opportunities for undreamed of scientific advances. We could start looking at travel, new ideas for communications, new ideas for different sources of energy. You know, material science could take a whole new height up in terms of our understanding of what materials are. you know, we have quite interesting problems around us about, you know, how did people thousands of years ago do all sorts of things that we can't even do now? Perhaps they had a greater understanding in certain areas than we have. I think it's fair to say that, of course, sages and mystics have been telling us for 1,000 years that the matter is made of light. You know, that's one of the fundamentals that we've heard from all sorts of mystics for thousands of years. And perhaps if we really took that on board and started thinking, okay, what does that mean in terms of what we can do, how we can relate to things? I mean, obviously it's a two-edged sword, because there is always the possibility that once you know things better, once you know things more, there may be other things that come out of it which aren't so nice. I mean, the fact that we discovered that we could get, you know, energy out of, you know, nuclear reactions turned out to be a two-edged sword. I mean, it provides energy in a good way, but it also provides Hiroshima's and Nagasaki's and things like that, you know. Science is neutral, basically, is what I'm saying. But I would hope that an advance like this would not just be an advance in science, it would also be an advance in awareness, understanding of what the universe is about, what we're about, how we fit into it in some way, perhaps. And of course, we don't need to forget that if everything's made of light, it means you and I are made of light as well. Every particle of us in our bodies is actually wrapped around light. And there is something about us that isn't that wrapped around light, which is our consciousness, and we then start thinking, well, what's that about? You can't just wish it away. Consciousness is a proper part of the study of science, as far as I'm concerned. It is not something, you know, to be pushed off on the God side, if you like. It's part of our everyday experience, every moment experience. So for me, it is a proper part of scientific study. And if we refuse to face that, then we're not facing elements of what we need to know in order to be able to deal effectively with our environments and our own situations. And I think it's fair to suggest that everybody on this planet could benefit, I'm not suggesting just from knowing what I know, but everybody on this planet would benefit from a new understanding of what material is about, what matter is about, how the universe all hangs together and so forth. And I really believe that issue between matter and antimatter that was brought out by Dirac and Anderson and these various other people who come through the Nobel Trail actually is pointing us to say, have a look at that. Look at it, see what it's telling you. Because actually, if you can figure that one out, you can step a whole quantum leap, I don't know if you use the phrase, a big step forward in your understanding of what matter is about, how you can make use of your environment, and how you can work with it more effectively. Well, that's about it from me, folks. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
I'm sure there must be some questions. They don't need to be directly on photons or particles or anything. Anything that in any way relates to what I've been talking about.
It's curious that if antimatter is actually compounded and therefore deficient, possibly, in your explanation, that it's collecting in places, and how do you know about this sort of like sinkhole of antimatter in the centre of our galaxy? I mean, what is that about?
Right, well, the way that we know at all about antimatter is because we observe its interaction with matter. Mm-hmm. It has effectively a signature frequency, or a set of signature frequencies. Like, for instance, just as a simple example, an electron.
So if you fire a radiation or a wave at it, then it will give off a
trail. We don't do anything with it. I mean, it's a long way from us. We're talking a long way away, Roland. But basically, what we see is energy coming off consistently at a certain set of frequencies, which are totally consistent with electrons and their opposite numbers annihilating each other. Mm-hmm. 511 kilo-electron volts, to be precise. That's what you get from static particles of that type. Right. So you get those sort of frequencies coming off, and that gives it the characteristic frequency of gamma radiation or whatever it might be. Right. Yeah. And for heavier particles, you'll get higher frequencies. But there are characteristic frequencies which you can look out for through a telescope, and if you see them happening big time through a telescope, you think what we've got there is a chunk of antimatter or antimatter gas annihilated, or being annihilated, mutually annihilating, with conventional matter.
So you see it happens. There's a sea of antimatter near the centre of our galaxy, which is either collecting or being annihilated.
Well, I think it might be doing both, because in fact the suggestion is that actually all sorts of intense activity around a black hole can create, because you it is, I mean, they have created sort of antimatter. We use it in PET scans. The P in PET stands for positron, mm-hmm. positron emission tomography. Mm-hmm. Basically, we are using antimatter in medical applications. We're creating that to use it. Mm-hmm. It's quite a done deal. It's quite an established science these days. But basically, it happens in a nuclear event, let's put it that way. So where you've got really heavy-duty nuclear events going on, particularly, let's say, on the periphery of a black hole, there's a lot going on there, and things are smashing into each other at, you know, relativistic speeds and so on. You've got all sorts of sort of nuclear stuff going on, and you've therefore got production of different types of particles, which could be pair production, as we call it, you know, production of an electron and its corresponding positron. So you see that going on, and basically what you're seeing is those things being created and then destroying each other.
And does that go on forever? What happens after that? What does it leave behind?
Well, I think it's... I don't think I'm qualified to answer that, because I'm not, you know, a cosmologist in that sense. But, I mean, my understanding is that as long as there is this frenzy and sort of froth of activity around a black hole situation, then you're going to have that sort of thing going on. Because all the time, the whole thing about a black hole is it's sucking matter in from around it, okay? So it's like a great big plug hole that's just sucking stuff in. Mm. And as long as it's doing that, there will be that activity going on. And there is no reason why that should ever stop, really, until the end of the universe, effectively. Mm.
But then, obviously, to me, from your talk just now, then antimatter will cease to exist. If it's inefficient to that level, where it's also being... Its creation is becoming less because it doesn't work. Then surely, I mean, that doesn't make sense. I mean, I grew up with the matter with the notion that there was as much antimatter as matter in the universe.
Right.
Yeah, and that was my understanding of it. And now you've been explaining that antimatter is this sort of like byproduct that is inefficient. And
well, let's put it this way. In the observable universe, and the observable universe goes a heck of a long way these days, there is no evidence of a substantial amount of antimatter. The universe is almost 100%, almost 100% dominated by matter. You know? I mean, I think, you know, yeah, when we were younger, there was this idea that we would one day spot a galaxy that was wholly antimatter, or, you know, whatever, or, you know, I mean, they still hypothesise the possibility there might be an alternate universe somewhere that is totally antimatter.
No, indeed,
the point about the antimatter dying out, I don't think that's going to happen, because actually, what I'm trying to describe is that around, you know, a black hole or something like that, you've got this continual cauldron going on, if you like, which is actually turning out these particles all the time. Okay, they'll perhaps disappear very quickly as well, mm-hmm. but they are being generated. It's a like a production line job, you know? Mm-hmm. And that will continue.
Can I just check, is it your understanding at the beginning of the universe there was an equal amount of matter and antimatter and now there's less, or what? Is that sort of what you...
I don't offer an opinion on that, okay. Because, I mean, if there's an asymmetry in terms of the structure of the particles,
yeah.
and I honestly believe there is, and I think the Nobel Prizes have confirmed that in certain respects. I think there's an understanding that there is some sort of asymmetry. And certainly CP symmetry breaking means there's an asymmetry. So there's a general acceptance there's an asymmetry. Whether that asymmetry means that we originally had the same number of both, but for some reason, you know, for because of the reasons of asymmetry, more of the antimatter particles have died out than the others, or whether it's because of this asymmetry they never got together in the first place. I wouldn't like to be drawn on that because I can't answer that. My perception of, you know, I wasn't there at the time, but my perception of goings on immediately after the Big Bang was that there was all this energy, but unstructured energy, I like to think of it as, you know, it wasn't necessarily photons, it wasn't necessarily particles, it was just stuff, you know, just, and it appears to sort of like, in a sense, because it's just seeding around in an incredibly... And you've got to bear in mind also that at the time of the Big Bang, the universe was the size of the smallest subatomic particle. It was small. Okay, a pinhead is massive by comparison with the size of the universe when it first started. In fact, it was a point singularity, which means it took effect in no space at all. It's all a bit of a confusion. Really. But basically, my understanding is that this energy was sort of seething about in all sorts of ways, and bits of it will have, in some sense, because of this seething about, have created like little closed loops. And once they created them, they held tight. Because once you've caught hold of your own tail, you know, it's like the Ouroboros or whatever it is, you know, the worm, you know, it holds on to the nature of the thing, the interactions, the energies within that would have caused it to stay like that. So I think it's just a random throwing about of all sorts of stuff in the sort of original primeval fireball, if you like to look at it like that, and that random throwing about caused some things to form particles, some to form antiparticles, but the antiparticles maybe didn't quite even get hold of it as well as the particles did, or if they did, perhaps they came apart because it was all going on so hard, you know, so much going on, that they would have come together and been thrown apart because they didn't have the staying power. And I, you know, it's a bit of a subtle distinction for me, and I'm not sure which I'd like to jump on that.
So, according to your theory, there couldn't have been a left-handed universe. There aren't other alternative left-handed universes because they're not stable.
Well, on the basis of what I've described here, I would not support the idea of a universe where everything's left-handed, it's all working. Unless, of course, there is a universe in which case Fleming's right-hand rule doesn't work and a corresponding left-hand rule works. Mm. In which case, the opposite would apply. Mm. So yeah, I mean, there may be a universe in which different physical rules apply. In which case, it's quite possible you'd have an antimatter universe. But in that case, it wouldn't be called antimatter, and we wouldn't be, you know,
yes,
with conventional particles, we'd be antimatter people talking about the other ones. There might be somewhere that's got negative electrons, you know, or negative positrons, you know. Yeah, that's how it works through this.
Is it just our own galaxy that's got antimatter in the galactic centre, or is it the nature of all galaxies that they have that?
Again, I don't know what detail we have on that.
Mm.
I know that it's understood, it's been discovered, found, identified, that most of the galaxies they look out there, that's out there, have a supermassive black hole at their centre. That is a characteristic of galaxies.
Mm.
And I think where you've got a supermassive black hole, there you're going to get this intense nuclear activity, very, very intense. And where you've got this nuclear activity, you're going to have abundant, you know, instantaneous production of matter-antimatter pairs, particle pairs, which will then very quickly annihilate each other as well. So you've seen that go. I don't know, you know, to what level they've been able to say, yeah, that galaxy over there's got the same thing going on, that galaxy over there's got the same thing going on. I do know that they specifically identify that there's quite a big flurry of matter-antimatter activity in a pocket near the centre of our galaxy. I don't know, you know, what degree of resolution they've been able to identify that elsewhere, because other galaxies are quite a long way away.
And would it have always kind of been there from when the galaxy formed? I mean, is it part of the formation of the thing?
Do you mean the black hole, or do you mean the matter and the antimatter? Or both?
I think both, really.
Well, again, I mean, I think there are various theories flying around about why there might be a black hole at the centre of every galaxy. I certainly don't know enough to be able to give a definitive answer on why it's there, whether it will have got bigger over the 13.7 billion years approximately that the universe has been going. Seems likely that it would have done, because if there's lots of stuff flying around with a big plug hole, less stuff would have been going down the plug hole. So it almost certainly would have been getting bigger all the time it's been there. And presumably, and I'm just saying theoretically, as long as you've had a reasonably big black hole there, you're going to have the sort of activity that would generate these matter-antimatter pairs, particle pairs. So that's just theorising and saying that's my understanding of it. But as I say, I'm not a cosmologist, so I wouldn't, you know, if somebody said, well, no,
of course, if the black hole was just a doorway, then it would be matter passing through that doorway into its opposite state, in which case you'd have possibly an explanation for quarks which come into existence and disappear out of existence at a random stage and actually make up the building blocks to photons, which is light, which makes up the building blocks to us.
Right, okay. Quarks don't make up the building blocks to photons.
Okay.
Quarks make up the building blocks to nuclear, you know, nuclei, which is basically protons and neutrons, which are in the centre of an atomic nucleus. Protons and neutrons each have three quarks in them.
Right.
Okay? And it's my understanding that quarks, my perception is that quarks
in the same way as electrons, are formed from loops of light in that way. Okay. Now, as for the black hole being a doorway, again, that's totally, absolutely totally outside my sphere of knowledge. I mean, what I do know, I understand to some degree why it is that matter becomes incredibly condensed. There is a problem when you go for a black hole, because it actually gets condensed to the extent that it's at a point. So you have an infinite mass at a point. And in fact, Einstein himself didn't believe that such a thing could exist. Mm-hmm. In fact, Einstein hypothesized the idea of a black hole and said, well, that's only a theoretical possibility, it could never really happen, because it would require infinite mass. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Now, the general feeling is, and you'll see that on Wikipedia if you look it up, Einstein was wrong. We do have black holes. My feeling is, possibly, it may not be so much that Einstein was wrong, but the perception of what's actually going on is slightly different. Whether it forms some sort of doorway into another universe or whatever, again, I wouldn't like to say it. It's wonderful stuff for a science fiction story, particularly in a rotating black hole, which theoretically a person could exist in for a finite length of time if they could just dive in and come out the other side. But again, we're into sci-fi stuff here. There is a wonderful book called C.T. Shock, S-E-E-T-E. It's a science fiction story, and it doesn't claim to be anything else. Jack, somebody, I forgot his name now. Basically, it's one of the classics, and it's about these guys out in the asteroid belt scooping up bits of antimatter. It goes back to your idea that there are bits of antimatter out there, but just fine. And using this incredible shovel device to scoop up bits of antimatter and use it for energy and stuff. And the big dream was to find some device that you could pick up antimatter safely with, you know, because there is this real problem. Of course, you can't have a fork that's got matter on it, and then they bang. End of fork, you know. And a big bang. So, yeah, but it's a fun book, you know.
Could I ask, if there's a plurality, we know there's a plurality of galaxies.
Yes.
Have they reached... Has any telescope or radio telescope reached the edge of the known universe? And it's my whole idea. The beginning, there could have been a series of beginnings. No, it seems to me of the universe rather than just one great big bang.
Yeah, I'm not a favourite of the big bang either.
It sounds strange. We haven't reached the edge with a telescope, so there might be something out there.
Well, there is
a clue. Yeah.
There are several points you've raised there, Geoffrey, which are interesting. Firstly, I would say that there are a number of people who are proponents of the idea of mini-bangs that go on and have gone on since the beginning of things. I myself have this on my blog site, my last blog posting actually, looks at this whole business of going back 13.7 billion years and discovering when you go back that the where you're going back to keeps moving away from you all the time. For reasons which I explain in myself, in a very scientific sort of way. And you never quite get there. And what appears to be a finite length of time just keeps on going and keeps on going. It's elusively just beyond. It's a bit like the frog jumping halfway off the lily leaf but never getting to the edge. And that's the way it works. That's my perception of what's gone on there. And I'm not at all convinced that we have this massive, sudden fraction of a second, boom thing. Yeah. I have a suspicion that it looks like that, the way we look at it, because of what time did at that time. Mm-hmm. If you read my blog post, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, because it's quite curious. But my next blog post, actually, which follows on from that, is going to say, and it actually gives you a step-by-step proof that time doesn't actually exist, in the sense that you understand it. But yeah, sorry, I think I've missed your question. You were talking about the fact that whether we've seen the whole point is that the universe began, so it's believed, around 13.7 billion years ago, give or take about a fifth of a billion.
This is a time factor which seems to be arbitrary, a bit arbitrary.
Right.
It keeps going back, like you say.
I don't think that's. You see, what I'm saying isn't necessarily what's being said by cosmologists generally. I mean, I'm making that point because I believe that there's an issue relating to the increasing effect of gravity as you go closer and closer to that original Big Bang event, and the increasing effect of gravity itself causes the slowing down of time. You see it all in my blog post if you have a look, and it's quite clearly spelled out there. What I was going to say, though, of course, is that since the Big Bang, there's been a steady expansion of space, not just, you know, things flying out through space, you know, things go flying out in every direction. If you have an explosion, things fly out in every direction. But Hubble discovered quite a long time ago now that space itself is actually expanding. Mm. So things are actually being moved in space by the fact that space is expanding. Even to the extent that photons of light themselves are being stretched. We're surrounded now by microwave radiation, as the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is used, if you like, as a sort of wallpaper to measure other events by in the universe. That radiation originally was incredibly high frequency, intense radiation, but it's been stretched. Those photons of light have been stretched, so they got longer wavelengths as the universe has expanded. Mm-hmm. Another consequence of this, which is what I'm trying to get to answer your question to some degree, is the fact that even though the universe has been going, so it's believed, only about 13.7 billion years, and therefore there couldn't be anything further away from us than 13.7 billion light years, otherwise the light wouldn't have got to us yet. That's not so. The general accepted view is that the actual visible universe, the universe that we can experience, stretches out to about 25 billion light years. I think that was the figure I was giving. Because the universe itself has been moving away while we've been watching it. So stuff that's now 25 billion light years away was only like a fraction of that earlier on. So the light that's come from that has got to us, even though the actual bits have been further away. It's all very complicated, really. Yeah? So yeah, we do have a fairly big visible universe to draw on for our experience and what we can see.
The big question, and we all want to ask, is what caused the Big Bang in the first place? You know, was it God or something else? That is a big, isn't it?
Yeah.
What made it bang?
All right. I would again say, if you go back, sorry, I say this in my blog, and actually I've also got a post on my website, which is the article that I wrote for the Scientific and Medical Network, which you're welcome to have a read of as well. By the way, that's the sort of picture I've got now at the top of my website. But if you go there, well, I haven't got it now, I'm working on it, I'm still doing a major revision of my website. But if you go to it now, you'll find a little wavy rainbow thing, which people have said looks too new agey and tacky. I thought it was quite sweet because it's supposed to convey the idea of light and waves and things, but everybody says it looks like, you know, new agey. So I've changed it to a photo that I took down at the River Bubby some years ago. Which
oh, so the Bubby, is it?
The River Bubby, yeah.
Yeah, like the darts.
No, it's similar, yeah. That's a classic. But actually, if you look, that up there, that is Clambridge, the old Clambridge, before they put that monstrosity over the side. Okay. You'll never see that view now, because now there's this stupid great bridge there. Mm-hmm. But that's the old Clambridge, which is basically a couple of logs across the river. Mm-hmm. And that's looking upstream towards Clambridge. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say was, at the moment, if you go on my website in the next, probably next week or so, you'll still see the old wavy sort of rainbow effect. Don't be put off by that. What I was going to say was, going back to yourself, I'll come back to you in a minute. What I was going to say was, in a sense, when we say, how was the universe created, who created it, what happened, why, my answer to that is you're asking the wrong question. Mm-hmm. And if you look at my paper that was published in the Scientific and Medical Network Journal, and particularly the last paragraph of that paper, you'll see why I say you're asking the wrong question, because it presupposes that our perception of time and space are as they are, mm-hmm. whereas my understanding is that we have our concepts of time and space are things that consciousness has actually superimposed on our environment, mm-hmm. to help us navigate through it, mm-hmm. and that actually time and space in the cosmic eternal sense don't exist, mm-hmm. and it's something quite different, mm-hmm. at which point the question of how did the Big Bang come about becomes a meaningless question. But that's getting slightly metaphysical, but not too so. David, I'm sorry.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I like that old saying, Graham. You know, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
Yes.
And also, in the beginning was the Word. You got sound and light in the beginning there.
Yes.
What do you think of that concept, too, the Hindu concept of the many manifestations of the universe? God or the goddess breathes it out and brings it back in again, and it all comes to a stop, and it starts up all over again. The manifestation and the withdrawal.
Yes, yes, I love that one.
Rhythm of the universe.
I love that. Can I just offer you just
what do you think of that?
I think it's great. Yeah. I think, and I like the analogy, because I have myself on a number of occasions drawn the comparison, not trying to push the Bible or anything like that, because I don't think this is a religious issue or anything like that. I think it's a scientific issue.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting because I think just about every ancient text carries in it things which actually relate to physical facts of what went on. And I think specifically, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And if you look at the scientific text, they tell us at the time of the Big Bang, what you got was a massive outpouring of photons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the two are exactly analogous. They're absolutely the same. But the interesting thing for me, we're talking about black holes a short while ago. If you think about the possibility that ultimately, if the universe does reach out and breathe out, I mean, the universe is heading out at the moment. That's the Hubble expansion of space. There are some suggestions, and they're quite weird the way they do their maths, because they sort of work on the premise that things are flying outwards and then they'll fly inwards with gravity. Whereas in fact, the Hubble expansion of space has nothing to do with gravity. It's more like a sort of very good example of it. I think it was Brian Greene's book on string theory. I'm not a total proponent of string theory, but I thought the analogy was quite good, where it's like, you know, a bun, the dough rising, and that bun is rising the dough, and all the currents in that bun are moving away from each other. They're not moving through the dough. They're moving away from each other because the dough is expanding. And that's how I see the Hubble expansion of space. And it's quite possible that ultimately it will then come back together again, which could be the breath, you know, that you're talking about. And it seems to me that the interesting thing, if I could just share with you just a very brief concept, which to some extent undermines some of my thoughts about time, but I think it all works if you just don't look at it too closely, which is always the best way to do these things. And basically, if you think about the fact that ultimately, if all the universe comes together, massive black holes are going to suck up everything else, and the biggest black holes are going to win. And effectively, what you're likely to end up with at the end of the day is the two biggest black holes have sucked up everything else, and they're coming at each other. And by the nature of things, in order to get any sort of symmetry in the universe at all, they must be totally equal in mass and have exactly opposite spin. Right? That's got to happen. So that when you get the two coming together, you get a total cancelling out. Now, the interesting thing is that the spinning black holes do strange distortion things to time, according to conventional theory. And I have this lovely idea, it goes into your thing, which is basically when these two black holes that have sucked up everything else that there was, they come together with a big whammy. It's the big crunch they refer to in the text. The big crunch. And the big crunch, of course, throws time straight back where it started from, and it comes out of the Big Bang. And it's not another universe starting again, it's the same one because it's the same time. Which means that time is close. I mean, Einsteinian relativity theory has this idea that three-dimensional space is closed in a four-dimensional hypersphere, effectively. That's in my books as well. That basically, like the surface of a ball, if you think of the surface of a ball, it's a two-dimensional space, but you'll never fall off it because it doesn't have any ending, but it's not infinite. How can you have something that has no ending but isn't infinite? Well, you've got that on the ball. You've got a surface that has no ending but is infinite. And you can have that in a four-dimensional hyperspace. You can have a three-dimensional space that's unlimited. You know, it never you never fall off it, but it's not infinite. And then if you think that time wraps around in the same way, it makes a lovely picture of space and time all wraps around in the thing, so it's a closed system. And when it comes back together, it's whammed together. Whoa, we've got a big bang. And actually, it's not going quite as fast as you thought it was, because you haven't allowed for the fact that time has been slowed down by the gravitational effects. But that's by the way. It's just an interesting game to play with your head.
But wouldn't you have the question there of what if it's all like a ball in a sphere? Mm-hmm. What's on the outside? Like, what would be the equivalent of the air around the ball?
Yes, very good question. And that again is one that I've addressed in my writings, which again, with the very straightforward catch-all, you're asking the wrong question. I'm not meaning you personally, but essentially, that question presupposes that distance is an absolute cosmic reality. Whereas my understanding is that distance and space, you know, the distances we travel, separation between things, is not an absolute cosmic reality. It's actually a construct of consciousness, which we use to make sense of things. And in fact, the whole business of non-locality, you know, the idea that, you understand what I mean by non-locality. You know, you can have two things that are kilometres apart, you tweak this one, and immediately, faster than the speed of light, instantly, this one tweaks in response. And that's been shown by experiment. That at some level beyond the quantum level, distance has no meaning. So the idea that the ball is this big or the universe is this big, it goes into meaningless, I think.
It's hard to get your head
around. Oh, absolutely, yeah. But it's so exciting when you start. Yeah. Again, if you look at that paper on the website, if you go to the transfinitemind.com and you go down the side, you see papers, click on that, you'll see the one which is Time, Light and Consciousness, which is my paper for the SNN. And if you nip straight to the last paragraph in that, you'll see what I'm getting at there. And then you might go back and read the rest of the thing.
The distance thing you're talking about, is it a bit like your picture there on the screen, where it looks like there's a tree which is further back than the water at the front, but in fact there's no distance, it's the same distance because it's a flat screen.
Yeah.
Are you saying that the fact, my consciousness is imagining you over there, when in fact really, this there's no space here at all, it's just like a kind of image, like that image on there.
Sort of, that's quite a good analogy, and I'm thinking also that in some sense, you and I are everywhere. In the sense that there isn't everywhere. Everywhere is a weakness concept. But there is no point at which you and I don't exist. We see ourselves as you know, fixed at certain locations in time and space. And that works for us. And we have to earn a living and drive cars and things like that. And it would be rather difficult if we weren't able to do that. But in reality, there is just one unlimited sphere of energy. Well, sphere is a meaningless word, because that implies distance as well. There is an energy which encompasses all of us and everything else and the whole of the universe, and all of it is everywhere. But we actually superimpose on that the concepts of distance and time separation in order to be able to work our way through our days. And it's actually our brains which are part of that created matter. Again, you can follow that through if you work it through. That this is my next blog goes into this in a bit of detail as well. Is that our brains, which are actually made of physical matter, follow physical rules, and the physical rules at this level involve a concept of time which we superimpose on things. Probably made it worse rather than better, but
yeah.
See what I'm getting at.
Can I ask a question about the galaxies? Would you say that the black hole is what holds the galaxy together, and if so, with what force?
There's no doubt that a black hole would be exerting, this supermassive black hole that we're talking about, will be exerting a gravitational effect on a galaxy. I mean, a lot of galaxies are spirals or things like that. And it's unquestionably the fact that there will be a gravitational pull in, and that the behaviour of those galaxies would be totally different if that black hole weren't there. Whether it's the fact that it's actually the initial formation of a sort of prototype black hole that actually started the galaxy coagulating in that region is another question. I mean, the whole thing about you get then into the whole business of I don't know if you've heard of Alan Guse's stuff about the inflation period at the beginning of the universe. Immediately after the Big Bang, in sort of tiny fraction of a picosecond, there was what's termed the inflationary period, which is actually widely accepted now as a period when everything went bang at an incredibly faster than the speed of light and so forth. And it was because things separated out like that that we've got this sort of coagulation of certain bits that then form galaxies and other stuff, you know, the large scale structures. Because there was a big question mark for a long time, how come we have large scale structures? And this was to some extent answered by this concept. Again, if you look at my previous post, I look at the whole business of the inflationary period in a quite different way, to do with this whole business of the gravitational effect of the Big Bang effect. But yeah, I mean, there's two things. Firstly, it will certainly be exerting an effect and holding it together. Whether the thing would fly apart if it wasn't there, we don't know. I don't know, they perhaps know. And whether in fact that was what caused the galaxy to come together in the first place, or whether it's a consequence of the galaxy gradually pulling in on itself, you know, I don't know. Difficult question.
Do you have a spiral memory? Do they always go around in the same direction, do you think? Is that clockwise as well? You know, I'm fascinated. They tend to go around in spirals.
There is a tendency to spiral, certainly. Yeah.
Some have a lot of branches and some have less branches.
Are you saying they always do?
Well, no, that was my question as well.
No, I can't answer that, to be honest. I can't answer
vortices
that.
They're a fact of life, aren't they?
Yeah, vortices happen, basically.
Vortices are life.
And effectively,
light and energy.
It's my understanding that solar systems, i.e. a sun
with a vortex,
has come about because of this vortex principle, which is why there are a heck of a lot more suns out there with planets than we originally thought. You know, when I was a kid, I had this wonderful encyclopedia that had this fantastic picture at the beginning, big, full colour picture, which showed our sun and this massive other heavenly body, which is about the same sort of size, flying past and pulling out a string of
stuff like a string of beads from our sun, gravitation, which became our planets. And that was convincing evidence that, that having planets was very, very rare. And we might never find another sun with planets in the whole universe. But of course we now know that wasn't how it happened at all. It's quite a standard phenomenon with the sort of vortex principle that things are formed on. And that planets are quite commonplace rather than being exceptionally rare. But I don't know whether it's always the same. You might find it's like plug holes, you know, the sort of like the northern half of the universe, it sort of goes one way and the southern half again. I don't know.
You hold your photon rule, well, it's, I don't know about rule, but your photon theory that everything goes around clockwise. It would seem that the spiral nebula I'm talking about, those wings, that they would go around in a clockwise direction.
I have that problem too with what you're talking about.
I didn't follow through on the
one-sided, the one-handed universe, I have a problem with.
What's the problem?
Well, it's just that I come from a sort of like basically Taoist and therefore, you know, two making the three principle of life, the universe.
Yes,
you know, the right-hand theory, sort of, even though it allows the left-handed secateur to exist in a lesser, you know, a less capable form, it is not so, you know, abundant, and therefore the right hand, you know, the takes precedence, and I don't have a precedence in vortices work anti-clockwise and clockwise as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, can I just take a little step on that, because I haven't said that only one of those things has relevance and the other doesn't. Can I just because what I've said, perhaps I need to step back a few slides, but if you think about the two different spirals, the clockwise and anti-clockwise photons, okay, what I've said was when you look at them with that magnetic field superimposed on the top of it, they are not symmetric. Therefore, if you form a particular type of structure, okay, let's say you loop it round to form an electron, and you loop the other one round to form a positron, for example, let's say that's what happens, then they are not symmetric. Therefore, it is quite possible that one may be stronger than the other, more robust than the other. That does not mean that the other form of spiral doesn't have a part to play, let's say, in creating centralized quarks. There will be other constructs in which that other one has the strength. Because we also have, in our ordinary material universe, not antimatter universe, we have negative and positive particles. So we do have the negatives and the positives. And I'm not saying this one's great, this one's rubbish. What I'm saying is that the nature of things are that this one's better for forming certain types of particles and this one's better for forming other sorts of particles. You know, it's a bit like if you ask a plumber to thatch your roof, he may not do a very good job of it, but if you ask him to do your plumbing, he'd probably do a damn good job of it. Whereas the thatcher may not actually make your plumbing very waterproof, you know, if he does it with straw. So it's horses for courses, and you know, the one spiral photon may be good for creating one type of particle, the other one may be good for the other one. And it's not reasonable to expect that every type of photon will be good for every type of job. That doesn't undermine your Taoist philosophy, which I would totally
agree with. There is far less of one than the other. I mean, in the Taoist symbol, you know, the black and white are equal, whereas in the right-handed universe, there's a lot more electrons than positrons. And I think the problem here is that it's people's religious beliefs lead to certain presuppositions about what is perfection. I don't know if it comes from the Greeks or what, but this idea that perfection has to be something that's in harmony, that's balanced, etc. But maybe that's just something we have to kick out, you know. Because what you're saying in a way is you're saying if the universe would be more perfect, well, we'd have an equal amount of things, then we wouldn't be here. So it's only because it's imperfect.
I would agree with that point you just made. I don't consider that makes the universe more perfect. I think the universe is pretty perfect if I can be here. You know, that's a selfish point of view.
What I'm criticising is the presupposition about what perfection means.
I agree with the point that we obviously don't want the universe with an equal amount of antimatter and matter, otherwise we haven't got the universe at all.
Exactly.
But what I am saying is, I'm trying to say is that both the clockwise spiral photon and the anti-clockwise spiral photon, in my perception, have jobs to do, but they're not the same job. That's my understanding. They both have jobs to do. They both have a part to play, probably in the creation of matter, but it will not be the same thing that they're doing. And why should it be? You know, it's a bit like we sort of like
I don't want to get into the sexist philosophy, but I think there are things that women are particularly good at, there are things that men are particularly good at. And then it's, you know, it's difficult sometimes to expect one to do what the other one's best at, you know?
I ask one more question. But I found it fascinating what you said about what would appear to be consciousness being out of time. Because this is butterfly wing thing, isn't there? And they say that the butterfly on one side of the universe can be fluttering a lot on the other. But in consciousness, it seems to me that there are messages being sent with no time factor. And how does that happen? And what is the nature of consciousness? I know you're working on this, and I'd love to see your latest article on Time, Light and Consciousness.
That was one published by the SMN a few years ago, in fact. But it's on the website. And it's, you can download it. Okay. It's freely available.
Yeah.
I think you might find that interesting.
And
I'd say, if you start by looking at the final paragraph, just to get a feel of where it is you're heading, then the rest of it perhaps will.
Because the last talk you gave here was focusing a little bit on that, and
yes,
racial consciousness. You had this theory, which I thought, maybe I didn't grasp it, it was like riding on the back of light, possibly. Is that
consciousness?
Yeah.
That doesn't ring any bells with me. No,
yeah,
that doesn't fit with my... I think I may have referred to is the fact that our perception of time is because consciousness is being drawn by our physical brains to follow a sequential pathway rather than a contemporaneous pathway. You know, consciousness of itself, as I think my perception is not limited by time, but that it actually accepts the limitation of time by being linked to the brain and being subject to the sort of step-by-step plodding motion of the brain, effectively. That's how I see it, but that's a vast simplification.
You think the soul is composed of consciousness?
Oh, taking me into different territory there.
Philosophy of science.
I'm not going to be drawn into the soul. I think getting into consciousness is far enough. For me, consciousness is a proper part of science. It's a proper scientific study. And it is inappropriate to say we know everything there is to know about science if you actually know nothing at all about consciousness or very little. Or you don't even acknowledge it as part of scientific study. It's something which affects every instant of every moment of every one of our days. And it is part of science.
It's a big theme now with SMN. You mentioned the Scientific and Medical Network.
Yes.
Endless articles about consciousness and experiments, near-death experiences, etc.
Sure.
Trying to improve one thing with them. So. I find it fascinating, really, articles.
I find it fascinating, and I find, to some extent, I have to be careful here, I think some of them left flights of fancy sort of take them a bit and draw conclusions which I don't think are totally scientific.
Mm.
But that's a personal view.
Mm.
But I think there is, to me, a clear distinction between consciousness and the soul. I think maybe just levels, really, in some people's perception.
Yeah.
I'm not denying the concept of the soul, but I'm saying to me that is truly stepping into the metaphysical.
Mm.
And I don't think that experiments that we can do physically can relate too well to aspects of the soul. I mean, near-death experiences and so forth, we've got repeatable phenomena there, which are very, very interesting. What they actually mean and what they're actually saying is open to quite a lot of interpretations. I think they're very exciting, but... I think I'd be very wary as a scientist in trying to draw any definitive conclusions from them.
This is the difficulty of the marriage between philosophy and science, isn't
that's
it?
Right, yeah, Oxford. Yeah. Any more questions? Sorry if I come around the house a bit, but I have got copies of both my books here if anybody's interested. I'll just wave them at you anyway. And I'm sure you'd like some safe people for presents. Roland,
of course,
having copies of your own already.
Of course.
Yeah. Yes, and if you do feel there's anything you'd like to write on the back of those slips, as long as it's not too rude. That's great. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's quite expensive. Yeah, I think it's just it's good to have a website.
Yeah, that's Tapestry of Light, which is the one that actually goes through. It's a sort of everyman's science. It's got, as far as I know, it hasn't even got a plus sign in it. It's got one equation in it, which is E equals MC squared, and that's only really to power up what Einstein said, and then to sort of like relate to that in some way. It doesn't go through any maths, it's very non-technical,
but it does try, in a sort of tomorrow's worldy sort of way, to take you step by step through the evidence and my understanding of why it can be shown that matter is actually made from light, and what the implications of that are in terms of inertia, gravitation, all sorts of things like that. It shows how you can actually derive various relativity-based formulae from it, not from a mathematical or scientific point of view, but just as an overview sort of thing. So it covers all of that sort of thing and points to a few other things as well. And that
was an illuminating book, actually.
Beautifully illuminated. Oh, can I quote you on that?
It's got
sort of black and white drawings and things, various effects. And this is that 675, by the way. And that one there, Breath of the Cosmos. I'm quite proud of this because this is effectively, as I see it, the first picture poetry book on quantum physics that you'll ever probably see. It's got sort of like photographs and graphics of various types. There you go, the creation of the cosmos thing and stuff like that. But it's all, you know, sort of like flowing font, and the text is actually laid out in such a way as to hopefully try and illustrate some of the points I'm trying to make. Each double page spread is basically a new concept, effectively. But essentially, it carries the same science. It's very scientifically based. And it carries pretty much the same science as in the other book, and actually takes it a bit further, but in poetical language rather than in. Well, you'll find a few places on Dartmoor that you're able to hate talk about. and so forth. So, yes. Anyway, that one's £11.95. I do have some very slightly imperfect, virtually perfect copies of these for a couple of quid off if anybody's interested. And those two come out at 10% off if you buy the two, that's £16.80. But anyway, that's the advertisement.
Sorry, Graham, can you repeat the title of that last one? Because I didn't get it on.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I thought you finished.
That's Breath of the Cosmos.
Right, okay.
Okay? Yeah. And that one's Tapestry of Life.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Okay.
Brilliant.
Can I just read you, if I just to give you a flavour of this?
Yeah.
Just to let you know how it feels, this first one. Stuff like this. Oh, and the other thing I'm quite pleased with is because I've self-published, I don't have to have all that stuff about ISBN numbers and, you know, copyright things and things like that at the beginning. You go straight from the very first page straight into the message of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get all that stuff in a very tactful, tasteful way at the back. But it starts, as I say, straight in like this. There is a breath moving through the cosmos, bringing life and form to all that is. Its touch is as gentle as a ray of sunlight on a flower, yet its power drives the furnace inside every star, the wheeling arcs of galaxies across the heavens, the cosmic destructiveness of every black hole, the cosmic creativeness of every supernova. Without this breath, there would be no sunlight, no flower, no star, no cosmos. And that's basically what I'm referring to in that, is the flow of energies that we refer to as light and its associated things. And that's where it goes on to from there. It describes, you know, like whirlpools, it talks about vortices and the creation of particles and all that sort of stuff. But again, all in this sort of poetic style language. Okay, so there they are. Thank you ever so much for all of you for coming. I really enjoyed talking to you and I hope you found it interesting.
Thank you very much.
Sort of what you thought it might be.
Brilliant. Thank you.